They illustrate it by an amusing story. A Buddhist monk was made by an evil spirit to choose any of the following three sins: to kill a sheep, to break his vow of celibacy, or to drink strong drink. The poor monk, after having pondered the matter, shrank from the first two and thought that the last would bear the lightest consequences. Once drunk, excited, and having lost all control over himself, he took a woman, and this second kind of intoxication led him to kill the sheep to give a feast to his mistress. But enough. Tibetan stories about monks and the Lamaist Church are a rich mine of fine humor, and if we are once sunk in it, we shall never get to the end of the chapter. After being entertained with tea, sampa, and different kinds of cakes, we received a full supply of provisions and went away, followed by many admiring eyes. At Shoa, the main track of the Po Valley crosses the river. The covered bridge, with its small watchtowers, is large and well built, all of wood. The gates can be shut on both sides when required. A considerable number of posters, on which are printed magic or mystic form mulls, cover it, and bundles of miniature paper flags, fluttering in the breeze, are hung in quantities on all its sides. The stream is supposed to carry with it the words of praise or blessing that are printed on them. The Tibetans, as well as the Chinese, are fond of decorating the bridges, the roads, and the peculiarly beautiful sites of their country with inscriptions of a religious, philosophical, or poetic character. Some travelers have thought proper to ridicule that custom. I find it impossible to follow them. A few lines of delicate poetry, a page of a philosophical treatise such as one sees engraved on certain rocks in Tibet, the meditative image of a Buddha painted in a natural cave, or even a strip of paper hung above a river or swinging in the air at the top of a pass, bearing the old Sanskrit Vishava Mangalam, joy to all, seem to me greatly preferable to the advertisements of whiskey or ham which decorate the roads of Western countries. I beg my reader's pardon. I am but a savage. At the end of the bridge there is a large mani lakhang with engraved stones, revolving mani wheels and a number of flags. From there one gets a general view of the Po King's Palace, merely a square squat building whose upper story is lighted by small windows and whose architecture has nothing especially striking. Our big meal and the time spent in inspecting the place had delayed us long. Nevertheless, as we were only at the beginning of the afternoon, we preferred to continue our way rather than remain all night at Shoa. The evening brought us to a village where we feasted again with some country folk. On the morrow we feasted in yet another one. If our Christmas had been somewhat dramatic, that first Tibetan New Year proved really merry. Yet how much merrier was to be the real New Year at Lhasa. But at that time the enjoyments which we were to find in the sacred city lay still shrouded in the mystery of the future. In the second village we were the guests of a large family of new settlers who treated us most cordially. While we were seated with the family around their hearth, I watched one of the girls kneading a big ball of dough. She worked at it for several hours. Yongnan, as usual, had made mos several times, and we began to feel sleepy, yet she still kneaded her flour. I was rather puzzled as to what would become of it, and I would very likely have continued to chat with the housewife in the hope of seeing the end of the girl's work and its outcome, but Yongdan asked permission to sleep, saying that I was tired and that we wished to start early the next morning. I could not say anything to the contrary, so we retired to a corner of the kitchen dormitory, and lay down under our tent blanket. Asiatics do not feel, as we do, the need of privacy and silence in sleep. Even sick people, unless they belong to the upper classes, lie amongst others who do not in the least refrain from noisy talk and loud laughter. I once saw an old, dying man, stretched on the counter of a shop while commercial transactions went on as usual between his son and the customers. And this man was not a pauper but a well-to-do trader, but neither he nor his son had ever thought it necessary to make special arrangements for sleeping. I know that even in Western lands one can find families whose dwelling is composed of but one room, but it is utter poverty which leads them to such a way of living. In Tibet, amongst country folk, the farm always includes a number of rooms, but none of them has really a special purpose. Wool, grain, provisions, plows, and so on fill the different parts of the house, and, for the most part, the familiar's general living and sleeping room is the kitchen. Our host said not to stay their New Year revels on account of tramps such as we, and so the merriment continued. We were supposed to sleep undisturbed by the noise, as true Pa would have done, but I naturally remained awake, and long continued to watch the Tibetans and to listen to their talk. Still fatigue prevailed, and I was dozing when a smell of frying dough aroused me to the reality of the situation. The girl had ceased to knead and was now frying New Year cakes in that sweet oil made with the kernel of the apricot stone, which is a peculiar product of Pomt. What a pity! Had we stayed longer, we would have had our share of them. And now they would, perhaps, eat them all and we would only get the smell of them. I am not particularly gluttonous, but the daily dish of tsampa and scarcely anything else was rather austere. This smell of fresh, warm, crisp cakes. I was enraged with the Lama. What was he doing? Perhaps he slept. That was too bad. I did not want to be tantalized alone. I extended my arm as far as I could, but it was too short to reach my hateful son. I managed to crawl toward him under our cover and discovered that his eyes were wide open. They are eating cakes, I whispered in his ear. Ah, I can see, he answered in a subdued, desolate voice. Do you think they will give us some? No hope. They believe we are sleeping. What a disheartening answer. So I remain watching the happy ones. But they could not keep pace with the girl and eat as many cakes as she fried. Those which were left over were heaped in a large basket and my hopes were concentrated on them. Tomorrow the cakes would be cold, but still they would be different from our everlasting tsampa. Should we get some tomorrow? The family lay down in its turn, on the floor under blankets, the hearth fire burned low, darkness spread in the room. I fell asleep. In the morning there still remained some raw dough and we ate fresh, crisp, New Year cakes, and carried away a good number of the cold ones in our provision bag. Until then our journey through the Po country had been perfectly peaceful, and I began to think that there must be much exaggeration in the stories which are current about the Pipas. Pipas, so Tibetans say, airborne robbers, each year gangs, sometimes to the number of 100, fall unexpectedly on their neighbors of the Khongbu or Danshai provinces and loot their villages. Beside these brinized expeditions, most Pipas are traders, pilgrims, or mere villagers, and find it difficult to let any traveler they may happen to meet on their way pass without trying to levy an undue tax on his baggage, however miserable it may be. A few handfuls of barley flour, a worn-out blanket, two or three copper coins, all is good to them. But if, as a rule, they let the poor folk who meekly submit to their demands go unmolested, they are quick to turn murderers when resistance is offered or a valuable booty expected. Truly, no wealthy travelers venture to go through the forests of Po. Only the poorest of the poor, as beggar pilgrims made bold by the fact of their utter destitution, are to be met along the tracks which cross the Pipas Hill. As for us, we have not met any outsider, either rich or poor, on our way. The few people whom we had seen on the solitary roads were all natives of the country, or settlers who had practically become Pipas. Events were now to take another turn, and that gay New Year marked the end of a period of quietness. The very afternoon after we had left the hospitable house where such good cakes were baked, we passed by an isolated farm just as a number of people were emerging from it. The New Year festivities were still going on. Some of the men who had enjoyed themselves were decidedly drunk, and the remainder were not very sober. All of them carried guns across their shoulders, and some made a pretense of shooting at us. As for us, we proceeded as if we had noticed nothing. In the evening I discovered a roomy cave in which we slept comfortably. We slept much too long, and delayed still further over some soup at breakfast. As we did so, a man appeared and asked us if we had nothing to sell. He regarded the contents of our bags, which were still open. Our two common spoons especially attracted his attention. Then he seated himself, and taking a piece of dried, fermented cheese out of his dress he began to eat it. That kind of cheese is very much like French Roquefort. Thinking it would improve our menus, Yongdan asked the man if he had some to SFLL. He answered in the affirmative. He had some at home, not far from the cave, and would barter one against needles, if we had any. We had a few which we had carried for this purpose. So the man went to fetch his cheese. We had not yet finished our packing when he came back with a cheese and followed by another man. The newcomer was much bolder than the first with whom we had dealt. He fingered the cloth of our tent and told us that he would purchase it. He then took the spoons and examined them, while his companion cast glances in the direction from which they had come, as if expecting other arrivals. We had no doubt about the intentions of the two pippers. The bolder one had already put the two coveted spoons in his amphag and refused to give them back, while the other one endeavored to take the tent out of the lama's hands. I realized that others had been summoned and were to assist in the robbery. The matter would soon become serious. We must frighten these two away and start in haste. Perhaps we would be able to reach the next village, and the thieves would not dare to follow us. I endeavored to appeal to the good feelings of the men, but it was of no avail. Time was of importance. We must put an end to the business, and show the others that we were not timid and defenseless folk. Let that tent alone at once, I commanded, and give the spoons back. In the meantime I had my revolver in readiness under my dress. The boldest of the thieves only laughed and, turning his back on me, he bent to pick up some other object. I shot, from close behind him, turning my revolver away from him. But his companion saw me and, being too terrified to warn his friend, he could do nothing but stare wildly at me. Whether or not the other fellow saw him, I cannot tell, but he threw himself backwards just as I shot, and the bullet passed close to his head, grazing his hair. Flinging the spoons and the tenler on dry ground, the two ran like hunted hares across the thicket. The situation was not entirely pleasant. The ruffians might have gone to fetch some of their kindred, the men whom they seemed to expect. I told Yongdan to tie the loads in haste and be off as quickly as possible. What would have happened, had we remained alone, I cannot say, for a party of about 30 pilgrims, at first four in travelers we met in Poyul, and the only ones we were ever to meet, suddenly appeared. They had heard the shot, and inquired as to its cause. It was annoying to be identified as carrying a revolver, for only chiefs and rich traders own these. Of course they thought that it was Yongdan who had fired, and later on when Thi asked to see the weapon, we produced an old pattern small one, instead of the automatic pistol that had nearly sent the Popa on to another world. We joined the party, and perhaps we owe our lives to this most unexpected meeting. We learned from our new companions that the Popa truly deserved their bad name, and we were soon to confirm this from our own experience. The party which we had joined was mostly composed of people from Zogong in the New Valley, the place that we had avoided by crossing the river and cutting through several ranges. The very day after we arrived at the Dokpa's camp where we had taken a guide and a horse to climb to the Anila, they had reached another Kaman's encampment at the foot of the pass leading into the Nagong Valley. Before crossing the mountain a number of the trippers unshed to sew new soles on their boots, and so the larger part of the band decided to remain one day more near the Dokpa's encampment to get this done. A few laymen and nearly all the women preferred to ascend the pass slowly, instead of lingering at the Dokpa's place. They set out and slept somewhere under the trees, lower down on the other side of the range. At daybreak a number of pippers appeared, proceeding, with loaded yaks, toward the Qin province to exchange dried apricots, chilies, etc., for barley. When they saw the poor pilgrims they rushed at them and took away all their blankets and the few coins they had hidden under their clothes. Then, learning that others were expected, they ordered them to proceed, without loitering on the road. They unloaded their yaks, drove them on the hills, and seating themselves near the top of the pass waited for the remainder of the party to appear. The trippers found them there, on the watch, like demoniacal spirits of the mountain, ready to prey upon travelers. The pippers asked them for some present, which is a polite way common to robbers of China and of Tibet. but many of the monks were armed with spear or sword, and preferred to do battle. The Pippas had swords, too, but the pilgrims were more numerous, and the valiant sons of Poyul were defeated. The Lamas joined their unfortunate vanguards the following day. Some of these, acting as guides to their companions, had already traveled to Powypacenti through the Gotsala. When they heard that we had been able to force our way through the ranges, they very much regretted that fear of the snow had prevented them from following the summer road across the solitudes, where we had had a hard time but avoided robbers. Of the three passes on that side, they knew only the Gotsala. Like most campers of the New and Upper Jayamo New Chu valleys, these people were exceedingly pleasant. We greatly enjoyed their company, and accompanied them for several days. But then, in order to make up the time they had lost in the highlands of Po, they began to race VDTH such speed that I left them to their sport, and fell back. On the second day that we spent VDTH that gay party we left the banks of the Po Long River, which we had followed from its source in the Snowboria Highlands. It was now a beautiful, large blue stream, about to lose itself in the Yutsangau. But before this merging of its personality it had still to receive a tributary as big as itself, the Yigong Tsangpo. We had to cross this river in the same way as we crossed the Jayamo New Chu, and before it the Mekong, that is Kosei, by hanging to a rope and being hauled from the opposite side. Our good luck had again brought us companions at that moment when they were so sorely needed. The Tupaza who make a trade of hauling the travelers across would never have taken the trouble for two lone beggars. We should, perhaps, have waited for days, camped on the bank of the river, until a number of passengers had collected. An insolent lot they seemed, these ferrymen whose ferry was a woefully sagging leather cable spanning a river at least twice as wide as the Jayamo New Chu where we had crossed it. Their chief seemed to be an old grandmother, who looked like a witch. She received the money paid for the passage and directed operations. At first the Pippas told us to wait until the morning but after repeated entreaties, and because we were a large party, they condescended to do the work that afternoon. Truly it was a difficult business. The Tupas were at least a dozen strong. To begin with, some of them passed the towing rope across, a real acrobatic feat that requires an uncommon strength in the wrists and a complete absence of giddiness. These men were not towed, as we, the passengers, would be. They scrambled unaided over that sagging and swaying rope at a considerable distance above the rushing waters. When they had reached the opposite bank, the passage of the luggage began, during which the old woman required from us all three needles or a little money as a supplement to the price already paid. Needles are in great demand in the interior of Tibet, and are very difficult to get. The Mother Tupa certainly made a profitable trade with those she exacted FRPM the travelers. Most of the men in our party belonged to the Lamaist order and to the great state monasteries of Lhasa, Sera, Dipong Ferryman or Golden. The old woman did not show any regard for them, but she approached Yongden and asked him to make mos, telling him a quantity of things about her private concerns. She also let us go without any needle tax. My turn to cross came long before that of the Lama. Passengers were sent two together, and I was tied at the hook with the woman in exactly the same way as at the Sailween. No accident happened this time, but on account of the greater length of the cable the jolting over the river was much more lively and unpleasant. From the middle of the river the wonderful snowy peak of the Jayalwapalrit, the victorious and noble mountain, appeared in all its splendor. Enclosed in the narrow frame of the river gorge, it had a peculiarly mysterious beauty which I had never seen in the wide snowy ranges. I hastened to find a shelter for the night, and came across a cave amongst the huge rocks which form the river banks. When Yongden arrived, I had already collected the necessary fuel. We had our food and went to sleep. The temperature was mild, and it was hard to realize that we were in the middle of winter. In the morning light the Jayalwapalrit appeared still more glorious than on the day before. It was a perfect jewel, one might have fancied it to be the immaculate abode of some radiant god, feeding upon pure light. Our companions, who thought much more of the gifts which the Lhasa government grants to the monks of the three state monasteries who attend the solemn New Year gathering, than of any god, were now in a great hurry to reach the capital, and did not lose any time in contemplating the victorious peak. When we started they had already all gone, and we found the large cave in which they had slept quite empty. This looked like an annoying complication, for the right trail to follow was hard to find in the dense jungle which now reminded me of the lower slopes of the Himalayas. I noticed a large number of plants and creepers which I was accustomed to find in the Sikkim forest between 3,000 and 4,000 feet level. The air had also entirely lost that peculiarly strong and invigorating savor of the dry tablelands. It never freezes in that region. The ground was muddy, the sky cloudy, and the people on the other bank of the River Gong had told us that we must expect rain. A number of trails crossed near the river. One led north toward the upper country of Potod where it joins tracks that allowed one to reach the grassy northern solitudes. Another went down toward the Brahmaputra, and a third one led to the Khongbu province. We started off correctly on the Khongbu track, but hesitated when it branched into a short cut and a main path. We decided in favor of the former, following mere intuition, without suspecting that the two would join later on. This short trail was a true masterpiece of the public works engineers of Poyul. It was cut by perpendicular rocks against which ladders of a peculiar pattern had been placed to enable one to climb up and down. At other places it ran like a balcony on branches thrust horizontally into the ground, and the whole device was built for tall pupas, with much longer legs than ours. Our feet were left waving in the air on the primitive staircases, whose steps were shaky stones all notched trunks of trees. What we could not do with our feet we had to perform with the help of our hands, hanging in the air until we touched a point of support, and relying on our strength to raise ourselves when climbing. Had we not carried baggage on our backs, we should have enjoyed the sport, but we were heavily laden. Knowing that no food would be available on our way, which lay through uninhabited fests, we had provided ourselves with a full supply of tsampa, which weighed heavily on our backs and put our acrobatic feats of equilibrium in jeopardy. But worst of all, we feared missing our road. Such a trail might lead to some forest village, but it could scarcely be the main highway from Khongbu to Poyula followed, as we knew by loaded horses and mules. We also failed to discover any trace of the party of pilgrims. 30 men would have left the imprint of their feet in the soft mud. It was most certain that our former companions had not passed this way. Yet, as we were proceeding high the right direction, I ventured to continue. After all, we were again alone. We had no gift to expect from the Lhasa government, nor was our presence requested to read the scriptures. It would be enough for our own enjoyment if we reached the Lamaist Rome in time to witness the various New Year festivities. We therefore had time to loiter over the country. Fresh meetings with robbers were the only serious annoyance we had to fear. The Pipa's villagers themselves had told us to be careful on this forest track, which they call the Po Southern Road. Po Io Lama four robbers haunted it and people ventured on this side only in large parties. But as we were now in that ill-famed region, being willingly or unwillingly compelled to cross it, it was useless to torment ourselves with the possibility of future danger, which could not be averted. This most uneven trail, on which we had expended so much exertion, ended near a beautiful, huge tree dedicated to some sylvan deity. And here, also, it joined the main track. Happily, we had not missed our way. This spot broke the monotony of the jungle in a pleasant way. The giant tree, from the lowest branches of which hung countless tiny paper flags bearing spells meant to protect travelers, appeared to be a mighty guardian against the dangers that lie in the gloomy forest. Around it spread that queer psychic atmosphere peculiar to places consecrated to nature's gods, which tells of times long past when mankind's heart percent is still young and naive. Our progress became more rapid now that we were trailing a tolerably good path, and I regretted having taken the difficult shortcut. I ought rather to have blessed the very friendly sylvan deity of that road who had perhaps suggested the choice to me. A little farther on I found in the middle of the road a long shoot of wild orchids in full bloom and quite fresh, as if it had just I greater than been plucked. I relate the fact because, as we were then in January, it shows that the whole of Tibet is far from being an icy cold, bleak country, like the region which extends from the south of Lhasa to the Himalayas. At the end of the afternoon we overtook the party of pilgrims, who were camped in a pretty clearing near the junction of the Bow River and one of its tributaries. Our arrival caused some commotion, and our new friends rushed toward us to ask us if we had met any robbers. We were astonished, and replied that we had not seen a single human being on our road. They could not understand how this could be, for they had met a gang of about 30 men who had tried to extract some presents from them. As they refused to give the least thing, a fight followed in which the robbers had been defeated and some of them wounded. Two of the travelers had been wounded with swords and had lost a quantity of blood. Another, who had been pushed violently and had fallen on a rock, complained of internal pains. At last, when we had explained that we had come by the narrow shortcut, our new friends congratulated us on having escaped the robbers on the main path. For, angered as they must have been after their defeat, they would certainly have stripped us of all our belongings. After having heard this news, I ceased completely to regret my tiring exertion on the shortcut. Once more I had been uncommonly lucky. Encounters with brigands are common enough in Tibet, and fail to impress travelers deeply, unless they are extraordinarily bloody. In spite of the three who lay suffering near a fire, the others did not feel in the least sorrowful or depressed. On the contrary, it seemed as if this little adventure had relieved the monotony of their journey, and had joyfully excited them. We spent a very pleasant evening. The Lhasa trippers related a lot of stories told in the capital, and the latest gossip about the Lamaist court, the high officials and the filings rulers of India. We heard, also, interesting details about the economic situation of the country and the political opinions of the clergy. Lastly, they took us into their confidences to a number of private affairs in which some of their companions were concerned. Thanks to them, my store of observation was further enriched. The big fires which the party had lit, and the noise made in the forest by cutting wood, attracted the notice of a few Papas villagers living on the bank of the river. Several men, who did not look perfectly sober, came, inspected our camp, and chatted with some of us. I suspected that they were scouting to ascertain our strength and would inform their friends of the chance they might have of successfully looting us. They came to Yongdan and asked him to remain one day with them to bless their houses and properties. The Lama, of course, declined the invitation, mentioning the necessity of making haste in order to reach Lhasa in time for the great New Year Munlam. They understood his excuse and did not press him, but added that they would send him their wives and children to be blessed the next morning. In spite of these soft speeches, watchmen were posted at night around our camp, but the hours passed peacefully, so calmly and silently, indeed, that, having pitched our tent apart from the others, we did not hear our companions starting. I then insisted on drinking our Iafi hot tea, a custom that I seldom neglected and which, I am certain, had much to do with the good health that not only myself, but Yongdan and all our servants during previous journeys, have always enjoyed. Whereas so many Tibetan travelers whose habit it is to start before dawn without any breakfast, even during the winter and in the coldest regions, often suffer from severe attacks of fever and other ailments. But this most excellent and agreeable custom detained us, and Yongdan felt very uneasy at remaining behind in that unsafe country. We were finishing our packing and I was bending over some pieces of luggage when he suddenly announced the arrival of robbers. I glanced in the direction he pointed out, and saw a number of people coming toward us, but when they arrived we discovered that they were women and children. In spite of the spirits they had drunk, our visitors of the previous evening had not forgotten to send their womenfolk and youngsters to be blessed. The latter brought with them a very acceptable present of chilies, which are a valuable article of exchange at Lhasa, and also some butter and dried fruits. So the dreaded robbers became in fact our benefactors. The ceremony of blessing, packing our gifts, and some unavoidable gossip delayed us still further, and when we started we had but little hope left of being able to rejoin our companions. It was wonderful indeed to have escaped so many dangers of various kinds and to be there, just as I had planned it, in Puyuli en route for Lhasa. Nevertheless, it is always presumptuous to rejoice too soon about one's good luck or success. I had not finished with the papers,